David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 360. I'm your host, Steve Raker, holed up in the comic book bunker along with Andrew the LA Rabbit and Whirlwind X Kevin, ready to make some new noise for 2021.
That's the Carnage cameo issue, right?
Oh, no, not Carnage. Marvel Noise is the podcast sponsored by nobody. You can stream and download new and past episodes on marvelnoise.com, where there is a complete episode archive. You can engage us and get alerted to new episodes on our Facebook and Twitter pages, and listen to other fine podcasts on the Deliberate Noise Network, helmed by Derek Coward, the Keeper of the Noise. Oh, and listen to our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where we talk about the indie comic books we are digging on. In this episode, we're catching up with each other after the holiday break and sharing some recent reads, including some Bronze Age binges. But before that, we're already a few weeks into 2021 here, so it's a bit late to do like a year-ending, best-of, wrap-up kind of a thing. But what we do have is our often talked about and never executed first attempt at a Marvel Noise coolometer in the style of the bullpen bulletins pages of the, was it as far back as the late 80s and definitely into the 90s when DeFalco was the editor-in-chief?
It was definitely a specific time span, yeah.
The old coolometers used to range from almost seldomly talked about comic book things and mostly other pop culture, TV shows and movies, songs and goofy things like belly button lint and, you know, wet gym socks. But here's our attempt at a Marvel Noise 2020 coolometer, keeping it more to the realm of comic books for all of our sakes. Otherwise it would be no contest.
Yeah, so I think I know what comes in at number one, or is that number 1,000?
Well, at which end of the spectrum, Andrew, just in case you're not aware, it's cool at the top, uncool at the bottom.
Right.
Well, I know what was uncool.
And somewhat neutral, like in the middle, you know? So, to shoot things off, I'll give one for each designation. How about I've got, for cool, Kirby Creations. Always cool. And still cool in 2021 here. For the mid-range of things, I've got licensed comics. They can really be hit or miss, and Marvel's dipped their toe back into things in that realm for sure. And my not cool first submission is annuals without a theme. Boo.
Immortal Hulk, definitely cool.
I've got still that on going. My list too.
Still strong. I remember I had like recency bias and I didn't want to. Like, that first year came out, I'm like, I don't know, guys, but mega cool.
Still the best book out there.
Still so grotesque, still so incredible.
And they've managed to change, right? It's not like the same big dramatic buildup. They've managed to hit a couple of crescendos and build things back up in another direction and get things, you know, get the suspense build back up. And they've really managed to adapt to being an ongoing series, which I wasn't sure that they were going to be able to. I mean, like, remember what the Vision was like when it first started? It was the Hulk at night and kind of traveling through middle America with different kinds of stories, and look where it is now. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, all the crazy mindscape stuff with all the different Hulks. I mean, if there was ever going to be a book with, like, massive footnotes.
Right. Well, let's add right along to Immortal Hulk on the cool. Let's add Al Ewing, too, because it seems like when he's been a real fine writer for the in the Marvel bullpen the last few years.
That's for sure.
Well, for me, 2020 was the year of looking ahead, because my top cool thing was Classic 2099, which I acquired giant piles of via eBay. So... I can look to the future and the past all in one with the fun 2099. I got a whole bunch of runs. I didn't get everything, but I was able to buy quite a big stack of them and have been really enjoying Ravage and X-Men and the whole crazy universe that existed in that short window of time. It's kind of neat that it has sort of it lived for that amount of time. I mean, obviously, yeah, they did the revival and everything, but I like that. It's a little pocket universe.
That first bunch of issues of Ravage that was written by Stan and had the Paul Ryan art, they are kind of pooped on, but those were actually pretty entertaining before they jumped the shark and he went feral and Stan was all, kind of what was off the book. The beginning, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, Spider-Man was fun. Punisher. There were lots of crazy kind of fun. And like I said, that it gave that feel of a whole universe you could mostly get your hands around, as opposed to trying to read, you know, 50 books a month or whatever and have it all. It kept it kind of its own little thing.
I can't keep up with your 2099 purchases, but I try.
Hey, I appreciate it. I saw you posting that you had a couple of Ghost Rider 2099s. You never... Never too old for 2099.
I bought them all the first time.
But I just look at all the creators, and it's like maybe I'll run into ones that are like really terrible, but it's not like usually. It's just different. Like it'll be like Ashley Wood is on this or something, and they'll be like, "Oh, okay."
Well, for. Long-time Marvel Noise listeners, we even talked a little Doom 2099. We had a few segments on it, so I know you boys at least like some of it.
We have to get back to that, too, because I'm not done with that book.
That's for sure. So if you want a mid-level cool-o-meter pick, how about Marvel Spider-Man Maximum Venom from Disney XD? I mean, while the season has been quality... Trying to watch the show this year is maddening. They went to like the two episodes as 1 hour model. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might be different if you're watching it like on Disney Plus or something, but still, it's like we get like 12 episodes the entire year, and you're like waiting like 4 to 6 weeks just for like that 1 hour of two episodes.
I totally lost track with being able to keep up with when these sporadic episodes were coming out and what was new and what wasn't, and they kept bouncing around. Sometimes they'd be on at night, sometimes they're on in the morning. Yeah. It's better to wait and see them on Disney XD where it's like, oh man, there was a whole series I missed? Like, there was a whole other season there?
I mean, it is like the worst schedule this year, and I'm like, this is not worth it. Like, you're tuning in, and it's like you're disappointed more than you're not. Like, I don't know if they had other, like, problems or whatever, but I'm just like, it's not working. Like, I might as well just wait.
Well, I haven't followed that, but we do have the Disney Plus, so I've been watching almost all of Spider-Man Unlimited. Speaking of 2099 hanging.
Ooh,
and that's about middle of the... that's also middle of the road. There's some good stuff and some problems in the Spider-Woman cartoon they have up there. I was able to watch all of those. Same things, like lots to like, but, you know, clearly it was an era when they kind of were some pacing issues, I would say. Maybe a little bit of trouble bringing it home, cutting a few corners in the animation department. But, I mean, they got a lot of heart. And just to throw it on the TV while you're doing something, having dinner or something like that, it's perfectly fun. I wouldn't carve out a bunch of time in your schedule, but somehow I've had some more free time in 2020 than normal, so it's allowed more TV watching. But yeah, I've been enjoying those overlooked Marvel cartoons from the past a little bit.
I'm gonna get to them because I recently signed up because of the shows are finally coming.
Right.
The MCU shows, so
the shows are coming, the shows are coming.
Yeah, exactly, right?
By land or by sea.
We got a Hulu gift for a couple of months, so I picked back up on Runaways.
Ah.
Which I had seen only the pilot of back when it debuted.
And now, if I'm not mistaken, you don't have any connection to that book, though.
No, and the show is middling as well. I feel like it doesn't move as much, and for having all those characters, so far they haven't really done a lot of running away yet. Quite a few episodes in.
It's funny, like, it takes, like, one comic for that to happen. Yes. And then in the TV show, it's way longer. But the thing is, they get to put all this extra depth into the parents, so that is a good thing.
I compare it to its related show that had the crossover. I much more enjoyed the Cloak and Dagger show, which I believe had about the same budget. I mean, that was Freeform versus Hulu, but the same kind of non-prestige TV, and I just felt that while there were problems, they took more chances, made it more interesting. The way they slow play out this Runaways thing, I'm like, holy cow, this really is a tribute to the early 2000s and that nothing is going to happen ever. But, you know, hey, I'm only 4 or 5 episodes in, so not bad enough that I'm not going to stop watching it, but I was a little disappointed. But I also like that it's done. So, like, there's just the 30-some-odd episodes. But I gotta say, I feel like the Distinguished Competition has some better live action with that Doom Patrol and Titans and those shows.
Titans? Oof.
Yeah, it's fun.
Oof. Yeah, I guess that's a word to describe it.
I like the Starfire. I think she's fun.
It's just that there must be a story on the choices they made with that show. Like, there has to be. And I would be fascinated on why they made certain choices.
My mother, who had read some of the old Perez, Wolfman, New Teen Titans back in the day, tried some of the live-action Titans and said it's horrible. They're all horrible. They're all horrible people. She said it was terrible. Take it from Mom. All right, for me, I've got a cool The First Year of Conan comics. For mid-range, I've got supernatural Spidey villains. They just don't always work for me. Mm. And for not cool, I've got the second year of Conan comics.
Oh no, Steve.
Enough said.
Well, I'm going to... This is going to be an all... I shouldn't say all. It's not true, but... This is what people say, right? When someone's popular or whatever, they're like, I wish he was doing all the books. So Guardians of the Galaxy is very cool. I mean, the first issue might have been a little shaky there. But since then, it's just been ramping up all the time.
Nice.
I will say for cool, for me, it's been a real lifesaver. The Marvel Unlimited app. It's really... I've gotten more and more... I mean, I always liked it, but I got my new larger tablet, and it's just great having all that stuff at my fingertips, and sometimes I do a lot of browsing, which leads me to my mid-level, and that's all the Star Wars comics on the Unlimited app.
Wow.
There's some great Star Wars comics, and then there's some that just aren't for me. So it's been fun. I'll just randomly, you know, pick a tranche of them and just gobble them up. And it's really interesting. You know, I definitely have my favorite eras and my not, but I also like that it's so different. Like, there's just, every type of art style, every type of story, every era. They really cover it all. I'd be hard pressed to. It'd be weird, I think, if anyone loved it all. I can see if you hate it all, if you don't like Star Wars at all. But
well, a lot of this Star Wars that you're not digging on wasn't Marvel at all, right? It's just on there because it's like it's the Dark Horse stuff,
right?
And those had their ups and downs over the very, very, you know, decades long time that they had the license. So it's not, you know, that's one of those asterisky kind of things where I've got the Marvel Unlimited as a cool 1-2 right there with you. But a lot of those Star Wars books that are on there and even some of the Conan books just aren't Marvel. It's funny.
Yeah, well, some of those Star Wars books have really popped this year in price.
Well, some of the, and I've been enjoying immersing myself in their return to the license. That's been kind of fun. But yeah, some of the older ones. But it's I would say if you like comics, you could probably find there's so many different creators. That's the other fun thing when you scroll through and you see how many different people have worked on a Star Wars book at one point or another. When you're like, that's kind of surprising because I'm in the middle of a John Ostrander scripted one,
sure,
which seems perfect for his kind of
he did Star Wars for a while, yeah,
bent type of thing, and I had forgotten. I was like, you know what, I like I always associate him with those kind of Black Ops Suicide Squad style, you know, a lot of behind the scenes machinations and everything. And so that was fun and reminded me that there's more, even though it's not an era of the stories that I'm that into, it was such a fun take on the character, and some of the art teams have been interesting as well. Yeah, check it out. If you're not like a big Star Wars fan, maybe search by creator or something and you can find some cool work by people that maybe you didn't realize worked on Star Wars.
I read the first issue of the Bounty Hunters. That was pretty good.
Yeah,
I'm not even a Star Wars guy.
Yeah, it's fun just to see. I read a couple issues of that as well because those aren't my favorite characters, but it was fun seeing what they do with them.
So for a more middling thing, Marvel Legends. I mean, I love that there's so many diverse characters and like all the uniques. I'm always there. And when I can skip a wave, like, it's cool. Like, I don't need to build every single thing. But some of those deluxe figures or figures with the vehicles, like, the price is, like, whack. Or then, like, it's like, hey, for an extra $10, you can get a few accessories. I'm like, why do I need that?
So you didn't
It doesn't
drop,
make sense sometimes.
You didn't drop, what was it, $500 for the HasLab Sentinel?
No. But that makes a little more sense, but I don't know, sometimes
not for me.
It's just... And then Squirrel Girl, it's like, why don't we give you a skinny Squirrel Girl? I'm like, why do I want that? I want a regular Squirrel Girl, not like, what if Squirrel Girl was skinny?
Well, they released a line for just for me. I don't think it's going to get a second wave, but I did get the 3¾ retro Marvel wave that's done in the old classic Kenner Star Wars with the 5 points of articulation and the basic card back. So I picked up that entire wave, which I love, but I think that's got a very limited audience. That lower articulation is not for everybody, but me, I love it. It's just like if your Marvel fits Star Wars. I mean, all right, obviously the Secret Wars figures back in the day weren't that much bigger, but they were enough that it sort of threw it off.
Mm-hmm.
And these are exactly in that scale. I mean, the only one that had an accessory was Captain America. But still, it was a classic Ditko-style Electro and Spider-Man. Captain America with his shield, Iron Man, Cyclops, Black Panther. And then they had, you could buy the extra, which was variant paint Iron Man with a different card back. And a variant paint Black Panther. So I got all of them in a rare, weird moment of Andy buying plastic again. But anyways, I love it. If you like that old format, please buy it. I don't think they're going to have another wave of it. So it's still in stock as of this recording.
For cool, I've got Deadpool and Elsa Bloodstone together. Then the pages of Deadpool's comic this past year. In the mid-range, I've got letters pages. I mean, it's fun to have them back, but They really need to do more with them. And not cool, straying from Cockrum designs. Just don't do it.
Uncool. This is a quick uncool, but lowercase lettering. Just admit this thing hasn't worked. It's harder to read lowercase lettering. I don't want to pick up a good comic and go, is there enough light? Like, less obstacles to reading, the better. It's just harder to read. Like, I know Hickman seems to be like, oh, we're going to do the whole lowercase. Ah, it's failed. I just want to read uppercase and be totally fine with reading. For cool, X of Swords. Totally cool. Could have just been some crazy Street Fighter battle, but totally turned out to be so much more. So different, more interesting. It totally changed up the pacing at times. Some of the battles are like one panel. Some of the battles are much longer. It was crazy, shocking, and fun.
Pulling that even more generically, I had X-Men crossover events in my cool column, but then everybody else's crossover events down in the low, middle, high, low section.
I mean, I think that's fair. I kind of plays into my uncool or sort of middling thing, Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
Very average. Knowing that Slott had written some great Human Torch and Thing stories before, I don't know. It's just a disappointment, this book.
I mean,
then you go over into Empire, and it was like more of the same. I don't know what's wrong, but it's not great.
That we haven't talked about the book at length really says something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm about in the middle. I mean, I don't know if I can prejudge it, but I've started the Avengers 2020 big game that came out over the summer. That was a Christmas gift. So I started it. I'm currently putting it in the middle. I feel like the best video games you have to commit, either you're going to be like that Spider-Man one that Sony came out with, where you really build it around the one character, or you go crazy like the Lego games or like those old Alliance games where you just offer a ton of characters. And if you offer a ton, you can just have the costume and one or two powers that make it. But this, it's neither fish nor fowl. It's enough of the Avengers, but they don't feel that different. Like the Hulk is more of a tank character and, you know, Iron Man's more the flying fighter, but they're not, it's not like you feel like you're playing Iron Man or Hulk in the way that the Spider-Man game did from a few years ago. I mean, part of it's about game design. Like, they want everything to be even, but that's not what I'm interested in as a comic book fan playing it. Like, if Captain America has to punch a guy three times to knock him over or whatever, I don't want the Hulk to have to punch him three times.
Right.
But I understand why you don't want an unbalanced game, but I like it when you either make those characters, maybe you can only play Cap on a higher difficulty, like find a way to build in that mechanic. But I think that's more for comic book fans than video game fans. And you're probably trying to sell it to video game fans because you know us dumb comic book fans will buy it anyways. So I think you probably want to, if you got to please one of them, I'm sure it's the video game people you want to please.
They also love to rush those games out on the developers and not give them time to do all of the things that they wanted to do with it, you know?
Yeah, but this, you know, like the end, it looks fine. I'm not a big video, like the animation sequences are fine and the story's fine, but when you're in there playing it, I don't feel as much like, you know, the Hulk should be a whole different feel than Cap or whatever.
And is this on the Xbox or the PlayStation, or which one are you?
It's on all of them. I'm playing it on the Xbox just because I have, you know, the Xbox I've been playing longer. So I have multiple systems, but I like that one. They kind of flip buttons around for instance, I'm playing a lot of Animal Crossing, and Xbox and Nintendo flip the A and B button locations. So when you're switching, it can be a little annoying when you're like, oh no, wait, those buttons are in the reverse order, which I'm sure they do for, I don't know.
You can remap, can't you?
I think you can, but I don't want to get too involved with all that stuff. I feel like the muscle memory comes back when I'm playing it, so I can remember, you know, like once you're back into whatever system you're in, it starts coming back. But I also hate that generation, and Kevin, you're not going to like this, that grew up on Mario Brothers. Because they always want to put in a lot of jumping stuff. Like, there's always going to be some hurdle. And I'm like, we don't need jumping challenges in every game I play, where it's some kind of timed, where you have to duck and dodge and jump in a sequence and all that. And I appreciate that all those people, like, Mario is in their blood, but it doesn't need to be in every game.
Andrew, you know what's uncool? The generation that grew up on first-person shooters. We do not need every game to be that.
Hey, no, we grew up on everything. We grew up every game. Every style of game was developed while we were growing up, so...
I'm just saying that I'm just over the... Oh, now... Miss Marvel has to like jump over all this crap. Like, I'm not playing to be a superhero to practice my jumping. I'm playing because I want my power fantasy to beat up everybody, you know, like Captain America does.
Also not cool, no new Marvel movies this year.
Oh,
yes, yeah.
That wasn't cool. But what was really cool was all those Marvel editions, not just this past year, all those Marvel artist editions, not just this past year, but in years past. The fact that Marvel has participated in the whole artist edition line through IDW has just been awesome. I mean, they just really stand out as a wonderful archival bunch of books. It's really, I love those things.
You know what was cool? Daredevil. The constant evolution of the title from what happened in the first issue, where I was like, I don't know about this. And then you go through the whole gang war type of thing, and it's like, oh, maybe I can just get Tony Stark to like buy up Hell's Kitchen and keep them safe as I have to do what I need to do. And then the Kingpin's ongoing drama at City Hall and him trying to get to another level. So good. So good.
Well, if we're doing... They're not artist edition, Steve, but I have both the Spider-Man and the Doctor Strange oversized full color, the Steve Ditko stories. One where they've taken a sampling of both. I don't know if you've seen them.
Sure.
But they're like the size of the artist edition, but they're just reproductions in the full color and all that. So I've been loving those things, although they are not handy to walk around with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You need like to set up a reading station. But it's great to see all that stuff in the giant blown up so big and with the coloring and everything. Yeah, I like the artist editions too, but there's something fun about having the full. And it's basically because it's the Ditko stuff. That's
and
it, why I got
and it's
it,
like how those Treasury editions were so big to us when we were littler, right? Like the Treasury editions seem small to us now, but it's that we're big. They're still huge. It takes a bigger book to make the same impact.
Yes, but I fully recommend. And look, I know everyone already has all those comics and multiple printings and everything, but I've really enjoyed both those giant backbreaking books.
Cool. The Avengers living in a dead celestial.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this Avengers book, actually good.
Not cool. Character resurrections. Getting tired of them.
Even the X-Men stuff? I mean, that's part of the concept.
Even the X-Men.
Like, that's baked into the whole thing.
Well, he was glad that Wolverine came back, Kevin. But everyone else after that.
When Moon Knight is stealing Ghost Rider's car and all everything like that, cool. That's the stuff I need.
All right, I got
uncool. Order dates, shipping delays, distribution issues. I'm like trying to order things, and then it's like it's out of print. Then it comes back into print. Then it's out of print. I'm like, how many copies even came out? I don't even know what's happening. I get stuff before the extended, like it's out. Then it's not out. I mean, there's just too many things to keep track of.
My last mid-range one is Heroes with Babies. Whether it's Cage and Jessica or Spider-Woman or the Avengers currently.
Franklin?
Captain America. He's not a baby. Cap a few years ago. Cable. All that. And my last cool is, I mean, of course, coming from the Marvel Noise guy, Bronze Age comics. Always cool.
Black Cat, definitely cool. I'm glad we finally got something happening on that front. That was good. And everyone's uncool. Corona. Not the Spider-Man villain. I mean, this whole year and all that entails.
I like mine with a twist of lemon.
You're not really going to put that mid-range, Kevin?
It almost breaks the coolometer on the uncool side. Like it's like the mercury or whatever the substitute would be at the bottom is like busting at the bottom of the uncoolometer.
Did you read the King Size Conan yet, Kevin?
Not yet, because I was prepping other stuff for this show.
Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit of what it is. Not necessarily spoil anything about any of the stories in it.
But I mean, it looks like there's a lot of cool creators. Like it says Busick and Eastman and everyone.
This is the Conan book we've been waiting for since the last good Conan book came out. And it's got the 50 years of Conan stamp on the cover and everything. It's a...
Shouldn't you say 40 years at Marvel?
Yeah, it should, right? It's got the Andrew Robinson cover that's worthy of a old Savage Sword of Conan magazine from the 70s or 80s. What it is it's 5 10-page stories, each corresponding to a different era of Conan's life. The barbarian, the thief, the pirate, the soldier, you know, you get the idea. The barbarian one is 10 pages by Roy Thomas with this Barry Windsor Smith-like art by Steve McNiven. Really looks good. And it's really clever because the story's a prequel that leads up to the opening sequence of Conan the Barbarian number 1 way back in 1970, which was the beginning of the Bronze Age and the year I was born. But that's fun that they tied it around that, like, the last panel of that kicks off the first panel of the beginning of Conan.
That's funny.
The Thief one is Kurt Busiek with Pete Woods. The Mercenary is Chris Claremont with Roberto Di Latore, who's totally channeling John Buscema. I mean, I used to love Di Latore's art in Iron Man, and he really found his streak there and got all moody, and he could almost do any type of scene and build the drama into it the way he did the shadowing and stuff. And here doing his Big John stuff, it's gorgeous. The Avenger is by Kevin Eastman. You know, it's Kevin Eastman, so it's silly. And The Corsair is a tale of Conan and Belit by Stephen S. DeKnight, who's one of the old writers from, like, Buffy and Angel. I remember being in the writing room of that. And art by Jesus Ciaz. And, of course, they got a map in the back that shows you where each tale took place and stuff. Yeah. And the letters page was like a breath of fresh air to me because it was the editor talking about pretty much presenting everything that they've put out of Conan since they've gotten the license back. And it really becomes clear. I mean, you know, there's this issue, there's the Savage Sword of Conan series, and the first 12 issues of the Conan book that were the Jason Aaron written stuff. That was really high quality, but the rest of the stuff since, it's not a good look. The creative teams, just looking at the names, you know, not too much disrespect intended, But it just, you know, they obviously haven't been putting forth their best foot. And it's nice to see this book come out because it shows that they still know what they're doing, basically. This issue was a nice surprise. And other people might be into the whole Conan's in the Marvel Universe and hanging out with, like, Deadpool and stuff. But I look at it for fun and because some of the artists, like Deodato, is great art to look at. But I can't take any of that stuff seriously.
I just picked up an eBay batch that had What If number 13, just so I could get Conan.
That's great. I love that. I love.
There's certainly pockets of fans that are totally digging that Savage Conan, Savage Avengers book with all the crazy cast members. So it's floating their boats, anyways.
You guys got any reads you've been checking out?
Sword. I mean, this was probably a gimme, right?
I read it too.
What? You were psyched by this, right?
Yeah, it was good.
I mean, it's pretty. I mean, it's going to get into. They're kind of in a weird place. Like you get the first like really potential setup issue, and then they sort of go into like tying in with Marvel Universe stuff. But if you're going to set up like that, have that big space station covering space stuff, and then something spacey is going on in another book that you can't ignore, it's like, I mean, you just gotta lean right into that.
That's good timing.
I know, but it's such a funny book. I mean, it's like the home of obscure mutants and nobody's favorites. I mean, Risk, no one remembers that character from X-Force. Peeper with the giant eyes. Acolytes, they like space, I guess, Steve, like Asteroid M and everything. And then Fabian Cortez show up and Magneto's like, I don't know who this guy is.
That's so funny.
Let me get away from this guy. So another winner from Al Ewing, and then what was it on art? Blanking. Chidi is I forget what the last book I read that they were on, but there was that Empire?
Maybe
they're on Empire. Anyhow, they're. I would say they're pretty. I mean, they're not like my absolute, like favorite level, but they're pretty high on my cool-o-meter of artists, I guess you would say. Because they sort of had that range, like nice facial expressions, and all that type of thing that can be overlooked. Like you have a lot of talking heads in this book, so you need someone to convey all this information. So, really exciting. Looking forward to a lot of greatness from Sword.
I don't know if it counts, Steve, but I read a new Stan Lee book. Stan Lee, A Life in Comics, came out in 2020 by Leal Leibowitz. Have you guys heard of that? My brother sent it to me.
Yeah.
Have you read it? Or?
Look through it.
Yeah, it's one of those that's not so much of like it bookends a little bit of Stan facts that are always of questionable veracity, usually lifted from other books if you look at the footnotes. But the main meat of the more interesting meat of it is looking at the early Marvel output and comparing the stories to stories from the Jewish religion and the Bible. And like looking at analyzing the characters from that perspective. And that's the real meat of it. I'm ignoring there's some silly bits where it's like Stan as a kid didn't read superhero comics. And I'm like, they didn't exist when he was a kid. You know, Superman came out when he was a teenager. There's not, you know, some of the, it just feels like a little, and then some of the stories that are more likely more apocryphal about some of the moments behind the history, and I like those stories, but I think it's important for us to recognize that we're likely never going to be able to really know the truth of some of those things, because they were a long time ago, and whatever witnesses were around, I don't know that I would trust their recollections of events from back then. And it got me thinking, I wondered if some other comic, like, it's just funny because they've become so valuable and so appreciated that I was just wondering if there are other sort of battles over the minutiae details of, like, Western comics or some, you know what I mean? If there's some forum where someone's arguing about who, you know, did the first good Roy Rogers comic, or, like,
I was the first one to draw Kit Carson at his true size.
Yeah. Like, all those kind of things that we as fans engage with at some level or another. I kind of wish he had just sort of noted that there's a lot of controversy. I mean, you don't have to weigh in, but I do feel at this point you have to at least mention that there's a good chance that some of this is not entirely accurate, or to whatever extent you give Stan credit for this or that or the other thing, you can go ahead and give that, but I think you owe a duty to your less familiar readers to at least remark that there is some debate about this. I mean, as there is with lots of history. Like, it's not like many accounts are settled completely, so I don't think it's unusual. I just think it's funny that it's become so heated. But anyway, so if you're interested in thinking about how the Hulk is like Adam from the Bible and stuff, that part was neat. I don't know. I'm not enough of a biblical or Jewish religion scholar to opine, but it was a neat framework to hang those stories on. But the comic book stuff, I'm a little, I don't feel it's a great.
Andrew, it's time to forgive him. It's okay now.
If you can only read one Stan Lee biography, this would not be the one I would suggest.
He can't hurt you with bad interviews anymore.
But if you have read loads of the books already, as many of us have, it's an interesting, just skip those first few chapters and get right into the looking at these characters through that lens. It's a cool way to think about those old stories, because there is a timelessness. There's something about that 60s Marvel that endures in a way even today, with all the reprints. And it can't just be me buying them. You know, I'm sure I've heard at least anecdotal stories of people sharing it with their kids and stuff, and they still get something out of it. And that's a world that I doubt they recognize at all. You know, people don't dress in suits anymore, and there aren't phone booths and all those other things. What? But
crooks will always wear suits and ties.
Yeah, they don't have, if you go out on the streets, you're not going to see everybody wearing a suit and jacket and hat and all that. But I don't know, I feel like there is something to think about with why do those particular batch of stories stay. There's got to be something to it, I feel like, past their merits, that's worth always examining and thinking about, because we don't spend as much time, not that the other stories are forgotten, but I would say certainly the attention devoted to that period far outweighs in reprints and discussions and everything similarly aged or even older or slightly younger. For instance, we've been doing a big deep dive on the Bronze Age of Marvel, which has been great, but I don't know that the Bronze Age has gotten nearly the same amount of treatment.
Well, everyone in the Bronze Age was fans of the stuff that was in, you know what I mean, that came before in the Silver Age there, and those creators are either no longer with us or almost no longer with us, so there is a definite romanticism of that throughout the industry in every decade following, because, you know, Roy Thomas, if you call him, like, you know, the ultimate fan of the, you know, the first fan creator of, like, the new generation, like him and Denny O'Neill and those guys, they were fans of that, you know, they were the Bronze Age creators who were fans of the Silver Age stuff, you know, and so everyone was, all the people who have done all the writing about comics, who were responsible for making reprints, etc., were all fans of, you know, they might have been creators in the 70s in the Bronze Age, but they were fans of that stuff from the 60s, so I think that makes a difference in everyone's hearts and minds.
I think so, but I still think there's something about, like I said, if you show those stories to people, they still have, I mean, maybe it's my own personal bias, but I much prefer that 60s Marvel to the other output, and I've tried, even with the same creators. I've talked about some of that Charlton stuff, even though I love Ditko. I don't think those Captain Atom ones hold a candle to the
they got what they paid for
work
over so, Charlton.
Yeah, interesting. Like I said, not my first Stan Lee book I would reach for, and this is probably going to get passed along. But it was an interesting idea to framework to view early Marvel. But it's so weird that they dress it as a Stan Lee. I mean, they put a little bit in the beginning and end, but it's, I guess it sells better as a Stan Lee book than as a the early work of Marvel book.
Speaking of love letters to old Marvel tales, we really haven't talked that much about the fact that last year was the anniversary of Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross's Marvels book. Maybe we mentioned a few of those snapshot one shots that stood out, but the third issue
for that series to come out. That's why
the third issue of the 5-issue Marvel series is out. With it's got a breathtaking Power Man Iron Fist cover by Alex Ross, and this Marvel without the S series is like an anthology of tales that span the history of the Marvel universe, all by different creative teams using kind of a Marvel style per se. And each issue has a continuing Doctor Strange framing sequence by Busiek, Darnell, and Alex Ross. This issue has a 10-page story by Alan Weiss. I love Alan Weiss. It's an almost Bond-like adventure of the Submariner in the Timely era. There's a 10-page beginnings tale by Bill Sienkiewicz that I'm not even going to try to explain here. But the gem of the book is this delightfully charming 4-page, although it feels like it's a 10-page story, Honeymoon in Hell by Ryan Heschke, a Canadian, Kevin. Some Welcome to Monster Town and Mean Girls Club. I'd never heard of him, but I'm going to be seeking out his other work because this was great. It's a Golden Age Black Widow marrying the Red Skull against his will and tormenting him with this honeymoon in hell, where one panel after another, it just gets worse and worse, and the Skull's expressions of not being able to tolerate it are just awesome.
Weird.
It's been a fun anthology series. There's still 2 issues to go, and it's really going to make a fine collection when it's done.
I have a yearly reminder.
It reminds me of that, remember when they did the Strange Tales, like, indie book? It kind of has that flavor to it, where each tale is different styles, but it's all done with a real high quality, because they're trying to keep that Marvel's style, not style, but just that Marvel's brand in mind. Yeah. What else you got?
I got Runaways. I think it probably... Did I bring it up last year? I know. I bring it up like basically once a year. We didn't get a lot of issues this year. Some titles were on hiatus, or were supposed to go digital only, and then Marvel changed their mind and decided to print them, which was cool, because I want to fill out those runs of those books or those miniseries or whatever. So Runaways was delayed, but whenever I pick that book up, I'm like, no one in the Marvel Universe has the issues they have. And if they do, it's pretty rare. They're not really... The closest thing is maybe how they called Defenders, like, it wasn't a... Like, this is the non-team.
Yeah.
Like, Runaways isn't really about fighting the supervillains. Although they do sometimes, for whatever reason, run into supervillains or decide to do certain things that leads them a certain way. Like, you had the conclusion of their whole LA arc where they were like the J team, the new hot team, and they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna be taken under the wing by this guy in LA, it's gonna be awesome. And you just knew there was something looming under the surface, and it turned out terrible. One of them almost died and everything. It was was pretty awesome. And then they also have to deal with the whole thing of they're just kids, right? I mean, some of them have part-time jobs now and stuff like that. Or then, since one of them died and came back, it's like their age doesn't match up with the other kid's age anymore. So the other kids could be like, I'm not going to school anymore. But the other runaway is young enough and like, I guess I got to go back to school. It is so bizarre. But in like regular Marvel Universe setting. So it's like the Marvel Universe is like the dressing to make everything so strange. Ah, so good. So enjoyable.
Nice.
And then they have this like sort of god hanging around with them. Remember one of maybe no one knows what I'm talking about. But the whole thing about Runaways is there was those weird godly beings in the series.
I never read Runaways, so I'll take your word for it.
it was sort of like it dealt with like the parents and all this stuff, and eventually you had to face those dudes. They needed a sacrifice and everything, and then those dudes came back, and of course I was like, oh, that's cool that you decided to bring those guys back. But anyways, needless to say, one of them is like hanging out with them now, and he's like always hungry. So they're like, oh, what can we do to like feed this guy's hunger? So eventually they resolve that, but then he also has to go to school. Hilarity ensues. So read Runaways.
So is it still ongoing now, Kevin?
It's still ongoing. Longest run of Runaways, can like numerically continuing and everything.
Wow.
It's still good. I mean, sometimes you don't get that. Like, they try to redo something. Like, oh, we're going to bring it back. And then you're like, why do you keep trying? Or it doesn't work, or it's different and weird. I mean, sort of like New Warriors. Like, how many times it never comes back properly? I mean, like, Runaways came back properly.
I think some of that has to do with New Warriors grabbed characters at a point in their time. And those characters aren't at that same point. So unless you're Flash, you know what I mean? I agree with you when they're trying to re-shoehorn it, but those characters had to have been developed a certain way up till then, and they've had so much history since that point, you can't almost put them back in the box that they were.
Yeah, and you don't want them to go back to the way they used to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a weird situation. I'm sure someone could solve it, but at this point, I'm just like, I don't really want to see them. Like, I don't know. It's painful every time it happens. I'm just, I would just rather not at this point and just read Runaways or some other teen hero book that's
more. Yeah, I was going to say, almost it seems like Young Avengers would have been the more natural successor to New Warriors, perhaps.
Yeah.
Dreamed I was an Eskimo.
All right, let's make a Bronze Age binge into some of our books that I've been randomly selecting on Marvel Unlimited. They got a nifty little button that you can just get little random comics and just push it and different little things pop up and it's like, oh no, another Star Wars Dark Horse book and nope, another this and that and that, something and ah, oh, there it is. And one of the times I tried my luck, Ghost Rider number 35 came up, which is a beloved book from my childhood from early 1979 when I was 8 years old. There's a Bob Budiansky, Joe Rubinstein cover that depicts the Ghost Rider and who turns out to be the Death Rider racing. But on the cover, they kind of look like they're a pair of alien xenomorphs bursting out of some dude's chest. They're like, just shoot now.
I don't know how you see this cover and don't want to see this.
Right?
It reminded me, Steve, of the old slot cars, those old plastic that you'd race around on the track with a little squeeze trigger type of thing.
This issue is a fill-in from the regular creative team, but what a fill-in it is. It's written and drawn by Jim Starlin with inks by Steve Lealoha, Al Milgram, and Mike Nasser. Milgram and Nasser. Milgram and Nasser aren't credited here, but a couple of issues later in the letters page, it's revealed that they chipped in too.
While I enjoyed this, the weird thing was the decision to give the Ghost Rider eyeballs.
Yeah.
Sent me back to going, I ended up reading the beginning of the Ghost Riders because I was like, did he always have eyeball? Like, did I miss the eyeball era or was that? And I think that was just what this team decided to, like, normally it's dots, but they gave him the full eyeball. Which
I think it's to differentiate him from the other skull.
Yeah.
Go, bike rider, right? I mean, because Starlin had done a series of tales featuring first God and then mostly death over in Star Reach magazine in the mid-70s. So it was like perfect sense for him to bring a skull-faced death character into the Marvel U as well. And sure enough, you know, decades later, he'd really get into his death stuff with the Thanos bit. With the Infinity Gauntlet stuff and Lady Death, but I mean, Starlin, there's something about the Starlin skull that really stands out to me.
I like the transformation. I was also, no prize, Death puts the eyeballs in there, I'll say. Because he's willing the transformation to happen, so he's like, you're going to have eyeballs this time.
Yeah, Blaze is unwillingly transformed into the Ghost Rider by this Death Rider, and he gets challenged to three races for three prizes. The first race is to reach a stranded biker, the prize being his life. The Ghost Rider loses and the guy dies.
Yeah, well, Death, Johnny considers it a bit cheating. I thought that the guy made his way before him, and I think he was not happy with the outcome of that race.
But isn't Death trying to force Johnny to cheat anyways?
The second race across the desert is to find a missing little, like, preschool-aged girl. And Johnny wins just by a hair by taking a shortcut. A great shortcut, though. What a shortcut it is.
It's interesting. It's the bike with the big front.
Yeah.
As opposed to the the more chopper-looking
right.
one.
Yeah.
Well, he does that whole thing where he's like, I remember it just like yesterday.
The third race is for Johnny's soul. They have to reach this distant peak. There's no way the Ghost Rider can win, so he kicks the wheel of the Death Rider's bike and it sends him off the ridge, crashing down into the rocks below.
No.
As with a lot of well-done stories with where characters kind of meet death, I like... Or maybe it's just the Starlin's depiction of Death is so, like, Death had such a cool attitude. Like, I love this confident, but morbid, powerful, yet playful. Something about Starlin's characterizations that really tickle my fancy.
Lord Death Man.
I wonder if Thanos knows that Johnny Blaze had a brief, fickle time with Death. Also, this character would have been a great variant for that Evel Knievel motorcycle toy. Like a skeleton guy riding a motorcycle. I mean, come on. That's a toy that sells itself. But yeah, they did a great job. Look, it's two motorcycles for a lot of this comic, and that's nobody's dream job, but I thought they had a lot of fun with it, and it worked for me, because I'm not, you know, vehicles in comics, as though it can always be tricksy, making that being the action element of it. But I thought it worked really well here, and I enjoyed it. I don't know that I would want to read, you know, 3 years worth of only motorcycle races or whatever, but
no.
It made a nice one here.
I don't need an X of motorcycle races. Of motorcycles. You have to go around the world getting your motorcycle.
I also thought it was fun that, like, the first guy, the first two people, they're just like, Death is like, you know, maybe I kill him, maybe I don't, type of thing. And it seems weird that they get dragged into this unrelated contact with, like, why does Johnny Blaze get this honor? I mean, it's because he's a daredevil or whatever, but it seemed a weird, like, way to kind of cheat that little girl and the guy fixing his bike. Although, to be fair, that guy was pretty stupid in the storm to be wandering in the middle of the road, so.
He needed help.
Yeah, you don't run. Maybe you wave him down from the side of the road, not the middle of the road, Kevin.
Speaking of vehicles and comics, another Bronze Age binge I had you guys join me on for this episode was Amazing Spider-Man issues 141 and 142, cover dated February and March of 75, so that makes them on the stands December 74 and January 75, which is important to me because I think this is, I think 141 is maybe the second Spider-Man comic I bought as a youth off the stands myself.
Oh, love these covers. I remember seeing these issues in like a back issue bin and being like, I must own those. Look how cool they look.
Jerry Conway.
Anytime you can get every villain on the cover, like that's worth it right there.
These are written by Jerry Conway with art by Ross Andrew and inks by Frank Giacoa with Dave Hunt inking the backgrounds. And it takes place during the build-up to the original Clone Saga.
Yeah. Creepy Professor Warren is in here.
And the Gwen clone makes an appearance and makes Spidey question his sanity and that kind of stuff. The issues open with Spidey being chased in the Spider-Mobile by police.
Yeah, Spidey for a license plate.
And he ends up driving it into the Hudson River. I mean, it
he
looked like
it
an,
was an alleyway.
Yeah, and it ends up being a pier and kerplunk right into the river.
Well, for those of you not familiar, it's basically like a dune buggy type of. There was this craze that gripped America in the 70s with these beach style dune buggy things that I don't even know if they make those style of yet. Well, they're not what they were, but for a short period of time, it was a cultural phenomenon that has long since gone away. So it's not even like a proper car. It's not cool like the Batmobile. It's like he's driving speed buggy around, but in Spider-Man dressing.
They made a toy and someone put the picture of it on the editor's desk and said, put this in the comic. So they did. They made it a bad guy, too, which was kind of fun. But in this issue, 141, later, Spider-Man steals a hamburger from just an innocent dude walking out of a McDonald's. It's like, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today kind of a deal. But then he gets attacked by Mysterio. And he's like, it can't be. I put him in jail 74 issues ago. They make a reference note to tell, and it's so long ago, it literally was 74 issues ago, and they're like, you know, it can't be him, but it's like more than six years. The illusions come fast and furiously, one after another, to the point where Spidey's fighting a group of famous foes like the Goblin and Doc Ock and less famous ones like the Molten Man. And he fights back, but he's just bloodying himself, striking a concrete wall.
Oh, that's so brutal.
And I gotta say, like, they really, this, they put a ton of detail. It's a really nice work. Like, the cityscapes are super well done, and loads of, you know, like, I know we goof on this era sometimes as being the blank backgrounds, which sometimes happen, but I gotta say, they check all kinds of great, you know, outfits and furniture and buildings and vehicles and just really populate the comic in a great way. I thought a heads up to everybody on this.
You put a guy's name on the backgrounds and he does a good job on the backgrounds, right? Hunt was trying to make a name for himself and wanted to get more inking jobs. And like you said, just knocked it out of the park so that Giacoa could just focus on the figures. They look great.
Because it can't be easy doing those buildings. I mean, you know, like, think about all that. That's not the fun, sexy stuff to have all the... Yeah, I just spent, you know, the day doing the dock, the logs under the pier that hold the dock up. And
and I'm not familiar enough with Ross Andrew's pencil style to know how detailed, you know, he did his vanishing lines and stuff for his buildings and things. So who knows how much work Hunt had to
you
put
know,
into
in other
it.
Parts of the world, the whole background artist thing would be quite normal.
Yeah. The next day at the Bugle, Peter tells Ned Leeds and Betty Brant that he got caught up in a tussle between Spidey and Mysterio, and Ned says, "That's impossible. Mysterio died in prison last year." And I'm like, "Well, I thought Kevin Smith killed him 25 years later." How many times was Mysterio dead? I thought it was a big deal when he died. I guess it wasn't.
Legacy title. You know, it's like, who can keep track of which Vulture we're on or which Mysterio? They need to wear name tags.
Issue 142 opens with another Spider-Mobile sequence. This time it's Spidey diving and trying to salvage it from under the water and failing. Mysterio appears on the pier and attacks him, and Spidey can't even touch him. And over the next few pages and some of the side plots and interludes and stuff, there's one thing stuck out at me of Aunt May looking like she had inhaled the Joker's mist there.
She's quite frightening.
She looks ready to take on the bat for sure.
I kept on looking at her face through the entire issue.
Peter throws a phone with Aunt May on the other line at Mary Jane, and Mary Jane has to dive out of the way because he sees an illusion of the Kingpin.
And I had forgotten that Mrs. Muggins went back this far.
Yeah.
Like, that's a character that I'm like, wow, I thought she was more of like late 70s or whatever, but nope. For all you Mrs. Muggins fans, she gets a nice little segment here.
And in one of my favorite little sequences, Jonah Jameson, who is still in the era of hiring villains to take out Spider-Man, is jumping for joy and clicking his heels in delight of his latest scheme moving forward.
How could that ever go wrong? I'm glad it's never gone wrong in the history of comics.
While smoking.
The thing I love is how much Mary Jane enjoys her instant vending machine coffee.
Yeah, yum. The perfect brew. Spidey discovers a button-sized image projector that was put onto his chest, placed there by Mysterio, and traces the signal back to its source and confronts Mysterio in his lair. He takes out Mysterio with a few blows to Mysterio's missing head, which is quite weird looking. And unmasks him, and it's not the real Mysterio, but it's Danny Burkhart, some ex-stuntman who used to work with the original Mysterio. When Mysterio died in prison, he left Burkhart the keys to the castle, basically, of the Mysterio stuff, and he took on the Mysterio role and thought he'd do Mysterio a solid and get back at Spider-Man once and for all.
Huh. I'm not sure why they want to paint everyone who's a stunt person. It's like, it's an industry apparently rife with criminals.
And alcoholics.
We never meet and here's the stunt man that, you know, saved a bunch of children or whatever. But I always love Mysterio because they had to explain all the gimmicks.
Right.
You know, with the superhero science.
And here's how I did it. And I would have gotten away for it too if it wasn't for those kids. The issue ends with Burkhart calling Jonah from the police station, demanding bail and a payment for a lawyer, or he'll spill the beans on their association. So Jonah freaks and skips the country. End scene.
I guess he canceled his reservations on a parade.
I'll be in France.
Yeah, there's no precedent with that, with the Scorpion or the Spider Slayers or the other thousands of great wacky schemes that he's backed.
It was a fun little two-parter that ends up being a breath of fresh air as we enter into what would become the first Clone Saga.
Yeah, that guy was creepy. I ended up reading I went back, a couple years earlier, the Punisher shows up in the same thing. The Jackal, scratches him to make him go after Spider-Man type of thing. Yeah, it's been... He was a weird little, creepy little dude snaking around all the time. Forget he wasn't, squaring up and fighting Spidey, man. Oh, man to Jackal, or Arachnid to Jackal, or whatever.
I enjoy him.
the last book I've got that I'm calling a Bronze Age binge, even though it's really a Silver Age book. It's more of a fantasy masterpiece, if you will. It's Marvel Superheroes number 15 from the spring of 1968. And I call it a fantasy masterpiece, rightly so, because Marvel Superheroes' title was formerly Fantasy Masterpieces, which reprinted Golden Age timely material, and now is repackaged as Marvel Superheroes with a brand new lead feature, and then old timely reprints.
This you mean timely or timely?
Timely.
Okay, okay.
Atlas, does that help?
Okay.
Timely Atlas. This issue's lead feature is Medusa. And I was kind of hoping, because it alluded to the Frightful Four on the cover, that this was going to tell the story of how Medusa first met the Wizard and company and ended up joining the Frightful Four. But no, it's just a new original feature. Written by Archie Goodwin, with pencils by Gene Colan and inks by Vinnie Coletta. Let the Silence Shatter is its title. Throughout the story, I think the figure work is really great, but and even the inks, for the most part, on the figure work is pretty good. The staging is great of the scenes, but the backgrounds are really sparse, and honestly, I'm guessing that that's Coletta's cosmic eraser at work.
Well, I thought, and to give out one other plus, I will say I do feel like the faces, there's a few nice faces in there. Because yeah. I know Vinny did some romance comic work that was supposed to be less erased than some of his other superheroes. So I'll give him that. But yeah, it isn't anything that anybody's going to be running, which is a shame because it's, you know, the Trapster and Sandman and Wizard and Medusa and all that. I mean, but it has that goofy plot thing too.
Oh my gosh,
Trapster!
The repartee between the Trapster and Sandman and the Wizard, written by Goodwin, is just it's awesome. I could read a Frightful Four book written by Goodwin every day of the week.
I don't think they're going to get a lot done though, Steve. They seem to really have some.
That's great.
Conflicted personalities.
The gist of the issue is that Black Bolt is throwing fit after fit, frustrated that he can't speak or he'd lay mountains to ruin and all that. So Medusa heads off to the world of man to find some assistance, and instead finds the Sandman and the Trapster led by the Wizard. They trick her into rejoining the Frightful Four and helping them steal some government-guarded Quadranium 99 that's going to power some tech that the Wizard promises will help Black Bolt, but of course it'll really just help the Wizard.
So, like, it's too much work for Black Bolt to learn sign language is what I'm doing.
And
like, maybe instead of smashing machinery, just, you know, learn sign or get a notepad and write down. They make it seem like he's trapped in some dimension and can't communicate. It really did. I don't. Out of all the superhero weaknesses to have, this one really struck me as
How about a whiteboard?
Overplayed. Just a overplayed. Whiteboard
would be fine. And it's funny, she aids them in the caper, but she pretty much pulls off the entire job by herself while they stand back and give her orders. She discovers their treachery when Sandman lets the beans slip that, you know, this is to help the Wizard with his gun, basically. And she turns around and mops the floor with them. It's so funny, though. They're in this little pod that's flying around, and I just picture, like, you know, it's shaking in the air as she's trashing the place with her hair, throwing these guys around. She dives from the ship's hatch as the Trapster is shooting like a barrage of paste at her, and manages to close the door behind her, so the Trapster glues the door shut and they're trapped in there, and she, you know, falls to her death if it wasn't for a timely save by Black Bolt flying by to save her. But what a funny issue. I love the Frightful Four.
It's hard to believe they can organize to open a can of tuna the way they get on each other, but I'll always take Pace Pop Pete Badlin, but yeah, the creativeness of using Medusa, who I never thought was a particularly powerful superpower. I mean, they really get Milo. I'm really surprised at the end she doesn't form like a hand glider out of her hair, because she can seemingly do anything else with it.
It's true. The one where she rolls up her hair like in a big tight like ribbon candy and totally pounds the Sandman. He's like, you know, I can just turn to sand and wither through anytime you grip me. And she's like, I don't need to grip you. I can just pummel you. And it's like, douche, douche, douche. And I just picture his head like totally bursting into sand bolts and then reforming with each hit.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is a weird, yeah, I don't know how it works or anything. It's one of the more fascinating kind of characters to push that to that level. But hey, it's fun. Medusa.
It's a weird one shot that I never thought, yeah, I never had come across. Was fun to check it out. And I don't know if you were able to look at the other stories in the Marvel Super Heroes 15, but just to give you an idea what else was in the book, there's a pretty fun Joe Manili drawn Black Knight tale that might as well be a Prince Valiant Sunday strip or something. It's so lushly drawn, and surprisingly the colors really come through. I mean, I'm looking at my old, you know, print comic, but the colors really look good on the book. There's whoever cut the Ruby Lith really was cutting some tight pieces there. That, you know, nothing bleeds or anything. It looks really good. And there's a great Bill Everett Submariner three-pager that goes back to his youth, where they're like in the Arctic and they go out and play on the ice, but they can only be out of the water for a certain amount of time, and the ice closes up and then they're trapped outside the ice. They got to get back in. Kind of fun. And then there's a pretty bad Black Marvel reprint, but the Everett story and the Manili Black Knight tale were both really enjoyable.
Cool.
All right, so why don't we make that another episode of Marvel Noise? I'm going to add one more little quick hit to you guys. There is a new Eternals series Kieran Gillen with art by Asad Ribic. The first issue came out, and it is really engaging. It makes it makes it a good nod to the last Eternals story and kind of, not necessarily undoing what was done there, but showing the outcome and the consequences to the Eternal who went bad. Never was bad before, but that was the big thing was, oh my gosh, it was one of the Eternals themselves. They kind of explain that, and he goes through his punishment, and they can kind of start again from scratch. And it focuses on just two characters, Icarus and that punished character, which really, I've said before here and on Indie Noise, that if you want me to jump into a new book with a new concept or a new presentation, a new angle, keep the number of characters down and give me, you know, draw me in. And that's just what they did here. There's an Iron Man appearance to make you smile if you need it, tied to the Marvel Universe, and a murder mystery before the issue is over, which makes you want to pick up the next ish. It's a strong start.
Hey,
it's beautiful too.
I'll read any comic that's got a Robot Hulk in it, Steve.
I'm not promising Robot Hulks, but here's hoping.
Wait, I thought you said it was an Eternals comic.
If there's a giant hand pointing up or down.
Yeah, will we get Celestials, Steve? Is the Prober coming back?
I hope so. It looks like they're in the movies, right? I saw some of the Lego sets for the Eternals, and there was a couple of the Celestials that we know and love.
Wow.
That's cool. A lot of Legos, Steve. That's a lot of Legos.
Yeah, do they have like a $300 Hasbro Pulse Eternal Lego thing?
If they're in scale with the minifigs, that's going to be an awful lot of assembly for you to do, Steve.
All right,
well, it's
guys.
Like those things you see at the cons. You know, they have the life-size type of things they set up.
Yeah, I've posed with the Hulk one. All right, guys, thanks for doing this episode with me and for taking on another year of podcasting here on Marvel Noise. Until death wins the race, make mine Marvel. Later.
Wow, that was rather bleak.
Make me laugh. no, no, no.